Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take the world's most dense reporting, slice it open, and give you the essential core of what you need to know. Today, we are undertaking a very comprehensive deep dive.
And we have a deep stack of source material to get through.
I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I will be your guide today as we navigate this complexity.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to help connect the dots across finance, policy, and global turbulence.
Our mission today is pretty straightforward. We are diving into the most important insights from today's most crucial reporting. The title of this deep dive is The Wall Street Journal for Thursday, December 18th, 2025.
Right.
For you, the learner, this means we're offering a full understanding of the day's financial landscape, the political battles, and these really profound anxieties, both at home and around the globe, all without the information overload.
We're looking for the patterns, you know, the underlying pressures that link something like a high-stakes corporate drama with a major standoff in Congress. And those pressures, well, they're starting right where the biggest money lives.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the state of the markets and this massive question mark hanging over the next year.
Yeah.
Can the market handle what people are calling the biggest IPO torrent in history? We are watching a monumental test of investor appetite right now, and it could signal the end of four very, very choppy years for new stock offerings.
That test is the debut of Medline. It's a medical supply company, and it just completed this blockbuster stock offering. It raised roughly $6.3
billion. $6.3
billion.
Just to put that in perspective for everyone, that's the biggest U.S. IPO since Rivian, the truck maker.
Since Rivian, way back in 2021. I mean, that's how long the market has been starved for a really serious high-value listing like this.
And the performance was, well, it was immediate. And it was overwhelming. Shares closed up a staggering 41% on Wednesday.
41% from their $29 IPO price. They're trading under MDLN on NASDAQ now.
That's not a small jump. I mean, that is a clear, enthusiastic vote of confidence from the market.
What's really fascinating here, though, it's not just about the immediate win for Medline and its private equity backers, you know, Blackstone, Carlyle. It's about the implication for 2026.
Right.
Medline's success is this crucial gauge. It tells us if the market has the appetite, the liquidity, and frankly, the faith to handle what bankers are predicting is going to be an absolute avalanche of blockbuster IPOs next year.
And when we talk about this torrent, we're not talking about small companies. We're talking about colossal names that could, I mean, they could reshape entire indexes.
We are talking about the ultimate must-own list. You've got highly anticipated companies like the rocket maker SpaceX.
Of course.
The huge AI company Anthropic, and even the government-sponsored mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're all looking at listings in 2026.
The scale here is just, it's overwhelming. I saw an estimate that SpaceX alone could sell stock well over the nearly $30 billion that Aramco sold.
Which is the current global record holder.
Oh, yeah.
We could be talking about a $30 billion plus deal from a single company hitting the market.
So that's the core challenge then. I saw bankers and fund managers are openly worrying that the market, you know, as deep as it is, might just struggle to handle this.
It's a real struggle. Because these offerings are so large, they will immediately become must-own holdings for the big portfolio managers. The index funds, the asset managers, they have to own them because of their sheer size.
Okay, but hold on. If these big funds have cash, why is it a problem? Why can't they just, you know, buy the new stock?
Because the cash isn't bottomless.
Right.
Right. And they have to stay balanced. To buy something as huge as, say, SpaceX, they can't just find that money under the couch cushions.
Right.
They literally have to sell something else. And they'll sell big established names, think Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, just to acquire these new IPO shares.
So it's basically a zero-sum game at the very top tier of capital. Mm. Jill Ford from Wells Fargo put it perfectly. She said, the bar will be higher because you're asking portfolio managers to sell out of a big established name.
Exactly. The market isn't just absorbing new companies. It's being forced to restructure itself to make room. And it's a huge risk. If Medline, a traditional business, does well, that's a great sign. But if the big tech blockbusters like Anthropic or SpaceX hit the market and then slump, they could just spoil the whole party for everyone else.
So it's like a weird dynamic of scarcity and oversupply hitting all at once.
That's it.
Speaking of market turbulence and high stakes capital, we've got a corporate drama straight out of a Hollywood boardroom. It's a showdown over Warner Bros. Discovery.
WBD, yeah. This is high-stakes M&A, pitting WBD against a hostile bid from the Paramount Skydance Group, and you've got Netflix sort of hovering in the background as another potential buyer.
This is a huge, complex deal, and the conflict just intensified. WBD urged its shareholders to reject the hostile $77.9 billion bid.
Right, the one from the Ellison family through Paramount Skydance. WBD is publicly signaling that they'd rather take a $72 billion offer from Netflix.
And that would be for the studio and HBO Max, right? Leaving CNN and TNT to be spun off. So why reject the higher priced bid? It sounds like it all comes down to trust. Specifically, trust in the financing behind the Ellison family's commitment.
Absolutely. WBD's opposition is all about these lingering concerns about the money. They're zeroing in on what they call an unknown and opaque revocable trust.
And that's the trust that's backing the Ellison family's equity pledge.
The $11.8 billion pledge, which is just part of a much bigger $40.7 billion equity commitment for the whole deal.
So WBD is basically saying, we need the wealthiest guy involved here, Larry Ellison, to stand behind this personally, not just some anonymous trust.
They want a stronger personal guarantee from him. And this demand comes at a really sensitive time for Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the family trust holds over $250 billion in assets, so it's not like the money isn't there. But his personal net worth has been volatile.
Right, because of Oracle. The stock rode this massive high after that huge OpenAI contract, the $300 billion one.
It did. But that rally completely collapsed. Oracle shares have plummeted more than 40% since then.
And that wiped out, what, something like $170 billion from his net worth?
An estimated $170 billion, yeah. And investors are getting really nervous about the amount of debt Oracle is taking on to build out all the data centers for that OpenAI deal.
Especially since OpenAI isn't even expected to be profitable for years.
Not until around 2030. So that market nervousness, even if it's just optics, it puts a huge spotlight on the reliability of that equity pledge. WBD wants a guarantee that goes beyond any one stock's crazy swings.
The turbulence seems to be everywhere then, not just media giants. Mm-hmm. We've got activist investors shaking things up across the board in retail and medical. And it feels like a broader theme of, I don't know, corporate governance under duress.
Lululemon is the big one in retail. Elliott Investment Management, one of the biggest and most aggressive activist funds, has built a stake of over $1 billion in the company.
And Lululemon has been struggling. Quality issues, stock underperformance. I saw the founder, Chip Wilson, basically said they had lost their cool.
He was harsh. And Elliot isn't just sitting back. They're moving fast to nominate a big name, Jane Nielsen.
The veteran retail exec from Ralph Lauren and Coach.
The very same. They see her as the perfect potential CEO, especially after the current CEO, Calvin McDonald, left. Nielsen's history is exactly what Elliot wants. She specializes in turnarounds.
So closing stores, cutting discounts, tightening up inventory.
All of it to boost profit margins. She did it at Coach after they overexpanded. And with Lululemon's stock down over 60% from its peak, Elliot's move is less about being hostile and more about a forced course correction.
And then there's also pressure in the medical device sector with Integer Holdings.
Yep. A $2.6 billion medical device outsourcing company, an activist investor, Irenic Capital, has built a stake over 3%.
And they want to refresh the board and consider a sale.
Exactly. Their argument is that Integer's stock trades at this persistent discount, partly because it doesn't have a lot of public peers to compare it to.
It's a really specialized business.
Very specialized. And because of strict confidentiality with their big clients, they can't just go out and tell Wall Street analysts about their product pipeline. So Irenic thinks the company is just inherently undervalued and would be much more attractive as a private company.
The constant search for true value, whether it's IPOs or M&A.
Always.
Moving from governance to heavy industry, we saw some disappointing news from major steelmakers, Nucor and Steel Dynamics. Both warned their fourth quarter earnings would fall short.
Nucor projected, what, 165 to 175 a share? That's a big miss from the 216 consensus. And Steel Dynamics was also shy of expectations.
And the reasons they gave. Seasonal effects, maintenance outages. It feels like the classic challenges in these heavy industries.
It is. Even routine maintenance at a big facility can have a meaningful impact on your quarterly profit.
But this sector is also where we're seeing massive innovation driven by climate concerns, which makes this next piece of news about Weyerhaeuser truly forward-looking. They're betting on a serious alternative to coal.
This is where you see sustainability goals meeting economic necessity. Weyerhaeuser, the largest private landowner in America, launched a venture with a company called Aymium.
And their goal is to take, what, runty trees and sawdust, basically forest waste, and turn it into something called biocarbon.
Exactly. And this biocarbon is intended to be a replacement for metallurgical coal, or met coal, which is a crucial ingredient for making steel.
This sounds like it's solving two enormous problems for the timber industry at the same time.
That's it. Problem one, the collapse of the pulp and paper market. U.S. wood pulp consumption is down 10% this year alone.
Wow.
Which created this huge, painful surplus of smaller trees that used to go to those mills. So this venture creates a new, high-value market for that waste.
And problem two is the climate issue for steel, which is notoriously hard to decarbonize.
And this biocarbon process addresses that. They use heat in the absence of oxygen to create a drop-in replacement for met coal. It aligns perfectly with global emission rules and the push to clean up metal production.
Have they tested it?
They've run successful trials. In fact, Steel Dynamics is already using the biocarbon at its Mississippi plant. It's a great example of the industry finding a profitable, efficient way to transition without waiting for some massive government mandate.
That's a critical point. Okay, let's shift our focus now from the corporate world to Washington, where these policy battles are exposing some deep political rifts, especially around federal spending and this domestic economic anxiety.
The Affordable Care Act subsidy issue is the main piece of political drama right now, and it's a story all about vulnerability and political leverage.
We saw four vulnerable House Republicans from swing districts in New York and Pennsylvania rebel against their own party.
They joined a Democratic effort, a discharge petition, to force a vote on extending the enhanced ACA subsidies for 3 years.
For those who don't know, a discharge petition is a really powerful tool. It's rarely successful. But if you get 218 signatures,
it forces a bill straight to the House floor for a vote, completely bypassing the Speaker and the majority leadership. And those four Republican signatures got them to 218.
That is a huge public fracture in the GOP right before a major election. And the stakes are immense for voters in those districts.
Around 20 million people on ACA plans are facing much higher costs because these subsidies, which were put in place during the pandemic, are about to expire at the end of the month. We're talking about a potential 26% jump in premiums next year.
And the Republicans who defected, they said they were pissed for the American people, which suggests they felt their own leadership was more focused on the ideological fight than on protecting their constituents.
That is precisely the political trap that the Democrats, led by Hakeem Jeffries, successfully sprung. They forced the GOP leadership to either look politically callous right before Christmas or lose control of the whole legislative schedule.
And the Senate Republicans are feeling the heat now, too.
They are. Before, they had ruled out a straight extension. But now, with the House petition succeeding, there are new talks about maybe a short-term extension paired with some reforms.
What kind of reforms?
Things like capping eligibility based on income, so truly wealthy people don't benefit, or maybe mandating a minimum payment from all users. It's a scramble to find a middle ground that saves their vulnerable members without giving up on their long-term goals.
So from healthcare subsidies to defense spending, the Senate approved the sweeping $901 billion National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA.
Right.
But buried deep inside it is this really controversial provision that seems to actively risk air safety.
We're talking about Section 373, and this is a perfect example of a dangerous technical little provision slipping through a massive piece of legislation. It actually rolls back safety measures that were put in place after that truly tragic mid-air collision over the Potomac back in January.
Let's remind everyone of that crash.
It was an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines jet. 67 people died. The investigation was clear. The helicopter had the ADS-B location broadcasting technology, but the system was turned off because of a pilot waiver.
A huge contributing factor to the crash. And the FAA's reaction was to require all aircraft in busy airspace to use that system, which seems rational.
It seemed rational, but Section 373 reverses that. It introduces this broad national security exception that allows military helicopters near Reagan National Airport, one of the most congested airspaces in the world, to fly without broadcasting their location.
That seems insane. You're creating the exact conditions that led to the death of 67 people, and you're calling it national security.
That's the ultimate irony. Military helicopters would only have to comply with a commercial collision avoidance system that's known to be inhibited at certain altitudes, making their operations inherently more dangerous.
Did anyone fight this?
Bipartisan senators, including Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell, denounced it. They called it a gift to the military that doesn't belong in any bill. They tried to remove it, but they failed.
So even when the government accepts fault for a tragedy, which the Justice Department did here.
They did. They admitted fault, said the pilots and an air traffic controller failed to maintain vigilance, and said the government is willing to pay damages to the families.
Even with that admission, specific branches can still push for exemptions that undermine the very safety lessons that were learned. It's incredible.
It really is.
And this whole context, the political drama, the defense policy, it's all happening against a backdrop of increasing economic anxiety, but, you know, not where you might expect it. It's focused on the white-collar workforce.
This is a truly striking reversal of fortune. For years, white-collar, college-educated workers were, well, they were insulated from economic shocks.
Right.
They were getting promotions, raises, seemed to have limitless mobility. Now they're filled with anxiety. And it's contributing in a big way to this widespread consumer pessimism we're seeing.
What's shocking is the data. This group now fears losing their job more than people with less education do.
It's a huge inversion. The average probability of losing a job in the next year for a college-educated worker has jumped to 15%. That's up from just 11% 3 years ago.
A 4-point jump in perceived risk is enormous for that group.
It is. And while their unemployment rate is still low at 2.9%, that is up from 2.5% a year ago. So it confirms a definite softening in their job market.
So the pessimism isn't just a feeling. It's driven by a real contraction in white-collar hiring.
Absolutely. Hiring in sectors like information and financial activities has really softened. Job openings in software development are way below pre-pandemic levels, just 68% of what they were. Marketing roles are at 81%.
Meanwhile, the jobs that are harder to automate, like direct healthcare, are holding up better.
Which tells you exactly where the fear is rooted. It's the looming threat of AI.
And this is where the warnings from top executives really start to hit home.
They are not pulling any punches. Ford's CEO, Jim Farley, predicted that AI will replace literally half of all white-collar workers in the U.S.
Wow.
Now, that might be a bit hyperbolic, but that kind of prediction fuels intense uncertainty. You see the human cost in stories of people who are laid off and are now consulting for a third of their prior salary. This perceived loss of stability for this specific demographic is a powerful, destabilizing economic force.
It creates huge headwinds for spending and investment. Okay, let's pivot now to global flashpoints, starting with the U.S. using naval assets to enforce sanctions against Venezuela. They're calling it a quarantine.
This is a major escalation of economic pressure against the Maduro regime, and they are being very, very careful to call it a quarantine.
Because a blockade is considered an act of war.
Exactly. And this quarantine is targeting a shadowy fleet of old sanctioned vessels that are used to export crude oil, mostly to Asian buyers who pay in crypto to get around the financial system.
And this,
it's the main artery. This network accounts for about 70% of Venezuela's oil exports. Losing access to it is estimated to slash their revenue by about $8 billion a year.
And the economic consequences of that could be dire.
Economists are warning that strict enforcement would immediately curtail the hard currency they need for imports, which would just exacerbate food and fuel shortages and stoke this already galloping inflation.
But the big question is enforcement. Can the U.S. Navy really stop these tankers effectively?
Experts say yes. The U.S. has the resources. We're talking about destroyers and frigates intercepting these tankers and escorting them to a marshalling area. Military helicopters are patrolling.
And has it worked so far?
It seems the threat is working. Some sanctioned tankers have already made abrupt U-turns to avoid the U.S. flotilla. And while Venezuela's national oil company is putting on a brave face, it's highly doubtful their Navy would dare challenge the U.S. Navy on the high seas.
Okay, moving across the Atlantic, there's a serious rift developing between the U.S. and Europe over the war in Ukraine.
Specifically over the Trump administration's push for a quick peace settlement. European leaders are in staunch opposition to this.
Why?
Their motivation is pure self-interest and deterrence. They're afraid that a bad peace, one that's negotiated too quickly and fails to secure Ukraine's sovereignty, would just leave Kyiv vulnerable to another attack and critically reward Russian aggression.
They see it as risking a wider war.
A wider war that could engulf the whole continent. The German defense minister said, "If we cannot achieve lasting and just peace for Ukraine, we will not have any guarantee for our own security either." They see Russia as a long-term strategic threat.
And Putin is leaning right into this rift.
He certainly is. He's calling the European leaders who back Kiev piglets who want to feast on Russia's collapse. He's vowing to achieve his goals either through diplomacy, and he specifically mentioned Trump's peace plan, or by military means.
Which sets up a direct confrontation between Europe's long-term view and the U.S. administration's push for a quick resolution.
A huge confrontation. But Europe has this massive financial leverage that they are now considering using. This involves the frozen Russian assets.
We're talking about over $245 billion in Russian assets held in the EU, mostly by a Belgian settlement house called Euroclear.
And EU leaders are meeting to decide whether to use those frozen assets to fund a $105 billion loan to Ukraine.
Which Ukraine desperately needs.
They're projected to run out of cash by the spring without it.
So this reparations loan proposal sounds like a legal workaround or a de facto confiscation.
That's exactly what it is. It's a highly creative legal maneuver. The EU would borrow a larger amount from Euroclear, based on the idea that the frozen assets will eventually be used for reparations. Then they'd issue an interest-free loan to Ukraine. And the critical part is that Russia's original claim against Euroclear for its money would technically remain intact.
So Kyiv would only have to repay the loan if Russia actually pays reparations at the end of the war.
Right. It's like using a guarantee instead of cash. The legal fiction that Russia still owns it is maintained, which avoids some of the most severe legal pushback.
Why not just confiscate the assets outright? Some people are calling for that.
The opposition is fierce, especially from countries like Belgium, where Euroclear is based. They're worried about being liable to Russia for a sum that's roughly a third of their entire GDP if the whole thing fails legally.
And they're worried about undermining the euro as a global reserve currency.
But the overriding political argument is that if the West just lets Russia get its money back after everything, it would be a profound display of weakness. The reparations loan is seen as a pragmatic way to get Kyiv cash now, while avoiding handing Putin a major win.
A high-stakes gamble. From geopolitical flashpoints, we turn to a tragic flashpoint of globalized ideology, the horrific terrorist attack in Australia.
Shooters attacked a Hanukkah celebration at Sydney's Bondi Beach, killing 15 people. The Australian Prime Minister confirmed the shooters appeared to have been inspired by Islamic State ideology.
They found IS flags and improvised explosives in the car.
Right. But the article connects this specific act of violence directly to the toxic rhetorical context that has saturated public discourse globally.
It links it to what the article calls the ubiquitous libel, that Israel committed genocide in Gaza.
The argument being made is that the relentless, globalized, anti-Jewish rhetoric things, like protesters chanting globalize the Intifada, laid the rhetorical groundwork that justified this mass murder even 9,000 miles away.
Let's talk about that rhetorical link, because that's the crucial insight here.
The argument is that when activists and politicians relentlessly demonize Zionists, treat Israel as a uniquely evil state, and turn Zio into the dirtiest word in their vocabulary, they are effectively pushing Jewish people out of acceptable society.
So they profess shock at the violence while having spent months laying the foundation for it.
Right. The author points out the hypocrisy of those who previously promoted conspiracy theories about the Zionist lobby, now offering these hollow condolences. The core message is powerful. Anti-Semitism rarely arrives wearing an explicit uniform. It arrives in the costume of the moment, making itself sound reasonable, even righteous.
And the article emphasizes Intifada means blood. It has always meant blood.
You cannot call for the globalization of a violent uprising and then act surprised when that call results in a terrorist attack on a beach. It's a tragic reminder of the real-world consequences of dehumanizing language.
It is. Okay, let's shift back to the U.S. and explore the ongoing scrutiny of governance and regulatory systems, starting with a major federal crackdown on telehealth fraud.
The Justice Department has indicted the high-profile Adderall startup Dunn Global and its sister company, Mindful Mental Wellness. This comes right after Dunn's founder, Ruthie Yahee, and its top doctor were convicted.
And the allegations here are incredibly severe. Systemic malfeasance, not just isolated incidents.
That's right. They allegedly provided easy access to stimulants like Adderall without a legitimate medical purpose, and then conspired to defraud insurers.
And the indictment claims They used this sister company, Mindful, as a reskin to get around pharmacies that had blocked them.
Exactly. To circumvent the pharmacies that had raised safety concerns, this allowed them to keep the prescriptions flowing and, according to the indictment, obtain over $100 million through this scheme.
The scale of the fraud the government is targeting is immense, not just in medical claims, but in welfare programs, too.
Absolutely. Federal authorities in Boston charged two men in a nearly $7 million food stamps, or SNAP, scheme.
They were operating these tiny neighboring stores that were somehow getting reimbursements like a massive supermarket.
One single shop redeemed $500,000 in food stamp funds in a single month, a huge red flag.
And this specific fraud case is being used to launch a much broader systemic critique of the entire welfare system in an opinion piece.
It leads to this fundamental structural argument that the core problem in welfare isn't just fraud by recipients, but the government's gross overstatement of poverty itself.
That is a very controversial claim. How do they support the idea that the government is essentially lying about the scale of poverty?
Their argument centers on how the government defines eligibility. They claim the method is flawed because it fails to count non-cash benefits like Medicaid, housing subsidies, refundable tax credits as income. They call this a fraud built into how various programs determine welfare eligibility.
The counterargument has always been that you can't spend those benefits on whatever you want. A housing voucher isn't cash.
They dismiss that as a specious argument. They say money is fungible. If you get a housing voucher, you no longer have to pay rent with your cash income. That cash is now freed up for other things.
So failing to count those benefits radically changes the picture of who is actually poor.
It does. They give an example of a single parent with two kids earning $11,000 a year. The government defines them as being in poverty. But that family qualifies for benefits worth over $53,000 a year.
So their total income equivalent is $64,000.
Which puts them at 254% of the poverty level. They're statistically middle class, yet they qualify for aid designed for the poorest. And that penalizes work.
A hardworking family earning 64 grand in wages would get almost none of that.
Exactly. The argument is that the system creates perverse incentives, and if you correct for this, the actual proportion of truly poor people in the U.S. drops from over 10% to less than 1%.
It's a fundamental critique, and that leads directly to questions of institutional definitions and governance, like this striking debate over the independence of the FCC.
This was during a Senate oversight hearing where the FCC chair, Brendan Carr, made a very poignant statement. He said the FCC is not an independent agency.
Which directly contradicted what their own website said at the time.
It did. He stated that the president can remove any commissioner for any reason or no reason at all. But another commissioner, a Democrat, was asked the same thing. And she said unequivocally, yes, and we should be. This public disagreement is highly unusual.
And the fact that the FCC website quietly removed the word independent during all this really highlights the fragility of those institutional boundaries.
It does. And it's critical for regulatory stability. Carr himself was being scrutinized for earlier comments suggesting regulators could potentially move against ABC's broadcast licenses because of comments Jimmy Kimmel made on his show.
Wow. Speaking of political tensions, we also had legal advisor Alan Dershowitz discussing his book on presidential term limits.
Right. Dershowitz said he handed former President Trump a draft of his book titled, Could President Trump Constitutionally Serve a Third Term? And told him the Constitution wasn't clear on the issue.
But the 22nd Amendment seems pretty clear. Is this a genuine debate?
Dershowitz seemed to frame it more as an intellectual exercise. He said he doesn't personally think Trump will run for a third term, and Trump himself has said he's not allowed to run. It's fascinating, but probably just theoretical.
And finally, we saw the announcement that FBI Deputy Director Dan Bongino is stepping down.
Bongino's departure caps a very tumultuous 9 months at the FBI. He had significant clashes with Justice Department leadership and the Bureau's career agents.
He was a highly unusual choice for that role, the first deputy director without a career agent background.
He was a former conservative podcaster and a vocal critic of the FBI. His appointment was clearly political, and his departure seems to signify the end of a deeply chaotic period at the very top of the agency.
That brings us to our final big section, culture, lifestyle, and human stories. And this offers a powerful human contrast to all the high-level financial and political battles we've been discussing. We start with a deeply tragic and devastating story involving filmmaker and activist Rob Reiner.
This is truly heartbreaking news. Rob Reiner, who was 78, and his wife, Michelle, who was 70, were found dead after a knife attack. And their 32-year-old son, Nick, is facing two first-degree murder charges.
And the context here is just decades of intense struggle with addiction and mental illness.
Nick had battled substance abuse since he was a teenager. It led to decades of unsuccessful intervention attempts by his parents, including more than a dozen rehab stints.
Rob Reiner even made a movie about it, Being Charlie, a dramatized version of his son's struggles.
He made it very public as an activist effort. They were trying to help him. They had allowed him to live in a guest house on the property where this happened.
And the night before.
Just the night before the bodies were found, Nick was at a party at Conan O'Brien's house. He had to be asked to leave after interrupting celebrities like Bill Hader with these strange, erratic questions. It's just a devastating culmination of decades of private pain.
A reminder that wealth and fame offer no insulation from that kind of tragedy.
Yeah, not at all.
Okay, shifting gears completely and looking for some lighter news, we move to a truly surprising business success story. The massive, unexpected boom in Costco travel.
It is a retail monster hiding in plain sight. People think of Costco for bulk groceries, not as a major travel competitor, but it's enormous. U.S. members booked over $100 million in travel in just the 5 days after Thanksgiving.
$100 million, up 12% from the prior year. Annual bookings are in the billions.
Billions.
So how does a wholesaler become such a dominant travel player? What's their secret?
It's classic Costco fashion. They leverage their 135 million members, and they focus not on breadth, but on immense value and high-quality curation. They are very selective.
Right, they're not Expedia. They only sell airline tickets as part of a package.
And they only use 4 car rental providers, and the perks are a huge draw. You often get a Costco gift card after your trip.
Which is brilliant, because that money goes right back into their store.
Exactly. It locks in future retail revenue. And their car rental program is often cited as a massive draw. Low prices, no extra driver fees, and you don't need a credit card to reserve it. It's the calling card that pulls members into their whole travel ecosystem.
From consumer success, we move to a story of profound endurance in Appalachia, McDowell County, West Virginia. This is the heart of the war on poverty, and the story is one of resilient self-reliance in the face of decades of federal failure.
The failure of top-down policy here is just stark. The federal government has poured over $3.6 billion into this one county since the 1960s.
And that's not even counting Social Security and Medicare.
And yet the systemic problems persist. 2/3 of households with children still need food stamps. Non-farm employment has plummeted 78% since 1975.
So after half a century, the community has just pivoted away from relying on outside solutions.
That's the key takeaway. Locals say we're on our own. Nobody's coming down here to save us. They're initiating these small, local, self-reliant solutions run by locals for locals.
Like teaching people to farm forested hillsides.
Right. A nonprofit co-founded by the grandson of coal miners is teaching retired miners and people in recovery how to farm, arguing there's no reason in hell the county should be a food desert.
And we also saw a former coal town trying to turn a shuttered Walmart into a mobile home factory.
An incredibly inventive grassroots effort to revitalize the economy from within. These efforts are small, but they are succeeding because they're driven by genuine local resilience.
But despite that resilience, the hardship is extreme. The opioid scourge, infrastructure failure.
The lack of basic infrastructure is horrifying. Undrinkable tap water, tinged orange from iron and manganese because the towns couldn't afford to maintain old pipes. A local pastor has to organize bi-weekly water drives.
It's incredible.
As one local said, there is a lot of fight left in these people. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
A powerful message. Let's wrap up with a couple of interesting culture snippets, starting with the unexpected boom in hockey romance novels.
This is a genuine cultural phenomenon. The book market is flooded with these steamy novels about love on the ice, titles like Heated Rivalry and Puck and Prejudice.
And it's huge on TikTok, globally.
Even in places with no hockey tradition.
So why hockey? Why not football or basketball, the established sports romance genres?
Authors and fans point to the unique athleticism. It's fast, dangerous, graceful. There's a specific physical appeal. Hockey players are famous for their thighs and butts because of the skating posture.
And there's a gladiatorial aspect to it.
The constant risk, the willingness to fight, people find it attractive. And the NHL is not complaining. They're calling it the most novel and surprising way new fans are finding our sport.
And our second snippet involves the long-awaited opening of the Studio Museum in Harlem.
The new six-story, $160 million building, designed by Ajay Associates, has finally opened its doors. It's a central hub for Black artists. Architecturally, it's designed to be in dialogue with Harlem.
I read about the reverse stoop.
This massive, broad, sitting stair that descends toward the street, monumentalizing the famous brownstone stoops of Harlem.
What are the highlights of the opening exhibition?
The main show, From Now, includes key works like Barclay L. Hendrix's painting Lottie Mama and Glenn Ligon's famous neon sculpture, Give Us a Poem.
The one that says M-U-W-A.
Right at the entrance. It sends this clear message that the museum, while proudly a Black institution, is focused on the shared human experience. It's far from separatist.
Before we close, let's bring some of these topics back down to the actionable level for our listeners. Let's talk cyber resilience.
It is absolutely critical. We rely on just a few platforms, Google, Apple, Microsoft, and if you lose access, you stop functioning digitally. Redundancy is your best protection.
What are the specific actionable solutions?
First, use a robust, modern password manager, and make sure you have a secure analog copy of that master password somewhere safe.
Right.
Second, enable passkeys wherever you can. They use biometrics or a PN instead of a typed password, so they're much more secure against phishing.
And what about that extra layer of human redundancy for a catastrophic loss?
If a site allows it, designate adult friends or family as trusted recovery contacts. They won't have access to your account, but they can receive a code to help verify your identity if you get locked out of everything. It's essential insurance.
We also saw this striking economic debate connecting the environment and government regulation, the cost of forcing green ideology on consumers in California.
This is about the Ivan Paul Solar Project, a $2.2 billion plant that uses outdated solar thermal technology. It produces power at four times the cost of modern solar panels.
And the utility, PG&E, is actively trying to shut it down to save customers money.
But the regulators rejected their plan.
Why? Why would they reject saving customers money?
To avoid stranding sunk infrastructure costs, they forced ratepayers to keep subsidizing this profoundly money-losing asset rather than admit that a previous regulatory mandate was a mistake. It highlights the severe cost of mandates imposed with little regard for market efficiency.
So as we synthesize the day's headlines, from the looming IPO torrent to the critique of the welfare system to the activism targeting Lululemon, what's the connecting thread you see?
If we connect all this, the day's major themes revolve almost entirely around the challenge of handling prior excess and correcting for overinflation. We're seeing this profound systemic reckoning.
A reckoning.
Yeah. Whether it's the market adjusting to overvalued IPOs or the government grappling with overinflated poverty numbers or companies like Lululemon correcting for brand drift and overhiring, everything is being forced to find its true, realistic, sustainable value. The past few years were about excess. Today is about correction.
That is a sharp insight. And it brings us back to the human element. We saw this intense, sudden anxiety gripping highly educated white-collar workers who fear being replaced by AI.
Mm.
And we contrasted that with the fierce, decades-long self-reliance in places like McDowell County, West Virginia.
The contrast is powerful.
It makes me wonder, what does the profound, sudden anxiety of the most globally linked, highly educated segment of the American workforce contrasted with the enduring, local, community-supported stability seen in Appalachia tell us about where true economic security and stability lie in the modern American economy? Where should capital, both human and financial, be best invested for the future? That is something for you, the learner, to mull over.
A provocative question indeed.
Thank you for guiding us through this extensive deep dive into today's crucial reports.
My pleasure.
And thank you, the learner, for joining us. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.